Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Success in America is coin of the realm, and the drive to be successful begins early. Some say it starts in kindergarten. SAT preparation has begun as early as elementary school. Computer coding camps are being advertised to children as young as 7. Add to that the drive by some parents to get their children into advanced placement classes and into colleges that require several extracurricular activities and civic projects, and the pressure can build to a breaking point. The stress can cause mental health problems. The World Health Organization says mental health conditions account for 16% of all illnesses confronted by 10 to 19-year-olds, and they often play a role in the third leading cause of death among 15 to 19-year-olds, suicide. All parents want their children to be successful. Most young people aim for success, too. So how do you strike a balance? How do we help young people navigate an increasingly competitive world and the stress that entails? We're going to pick the brains of an expert panel. Tom Franz is head of Trinity Episcopal School here in Charlotte. They are hosting a roundtable discussion on this very topic tomorrow evening at 6:30 at the school. We'll have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. Tom, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Dr. Melanie Powell is also here. She's a pediatric neuropsychologist and founder and managing psychologist at MindSpark, which provides psychological and education services to children. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Louise Serio is with us. She's an Emmy Award-winning former CBS News reporter and producer who produced, who worked, as a White House producer for the network and coordinated their coverage of the Parkland shootings. Thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Good morning. So, although pressures from school can certainly lead to student stress and possibly to mental health problems, they aren't the only contributing factor, I would think. We live in a world that is not just school if you're a child. Has anyone calculated the ratio of school-related stress to the stress that comes from all the outside sources? Do we know that, Doctor?
I don't know that we know. I can't think of a specific study that cites that, but I've seen research that's pointed to things like competitive sports and how we're pushing those down at younger and younger ages and the pressure that comes from performing at those high levels. So what used to be perhaps in my generation or a generation ago, more of an outlet for fun and relaxation and mental restoration, I think has become equally stressful.
I want to come back to that because I had the same thought. But the other thing is I've watched my niece and nephew grow up. They went from one game to the next. They were in two or three basketball leagues and softball leagues, and literally one game would end and my brother would quickly usher them into the car, drive them across town, and they'd play in another game. And this went on every weekend. Is that just, are we asking too much?
Yes.
Parents who are able to send their children to your school, to private school, and I don't want to pick on Episcopal, but it's a private school, they have success on their minds. That's why they're sending their children there as opposed, I would think, to public school. Do you see additional pressure being put on the children who come to you by their parents?
By some, I would say. I think overall we have a culture that really mitigates a lot of this or works really hard, a mission that's focused on really the whole child and trying to bring balance. And yet we have some high-power parents who are really driven and think of success in very narrow terms. And I think what we're trying to do at Trinity is to broaden what it means to be successful, broaden what it means to have balance, broaden what it means to mitigate some stress.
I've read through some of what the Trinity describes itself as to people who are considering going there and to the parents who have children enrolled there, and they're all wonderful goals and objectives, and it sounds very laid back and low key, but is it?
Well, I would say, you know, it actually is for some families. I mean, I think for some families, they're getting exactly what they signed up for, and we probably have some families that want us to be more stressful in lots of ways. And I have been at some of the great independent schools across America, and that were really high pressure, traditional schools, went all the way through high school, and we had to do college prep. And Trinity's got a very different spirit about it, a very different approach to it. And it may be in part that we're not preparing kids for college, and that's where a lot of the really stressful stuff can happen.
Mm. Well, if I'm not mistaken, Louise, you are an alumnus.
I am, and I was about to interrupt because I think I can speak to this a little bit, that Trinity especially, I think we chose Trinity, my parents did, because they wanted a place where their children would be really supported. Mm-hmm. And so for some people that looks like success, but to have a child supported for whatever that child is and whatever that child wants to become is a really important thing. And I think it's sometimes lost in this sort of pressure race. But, you know, I had on paper, a very successful resume. And I think that a lot of that came from the confidence, actually, of a place like Trinity that wasn't stacking us up against each other, but actually empowering every individual for what that is.
You chose, after college, to go into a really pressure cooker
I did.
Situation.
Yes, sir.
Not just the news business, but the network news
yes.
business, which is much more stressful than mm-hmm. anybody can possibly imagine. Think network news. That was your job.
That was. In fact, so Holly Hunter in network news, in that movie, is actually based off of Susan Zirinsky,
right,
who is the president of CBS News. So definitely, you're absolutely right on that one.
So you obviously thrive, or at least thrived for a while, because you've moved on to other mm-hmm. adventures in that environment, but not everybody does. And I'm wondering what role exposure to news plays mm-hmm. in young people's lives, because it's not just academic achievement or athletic achievement or social media, which we'll talk about. It's also, even though they're not great news consumers, most mm-hmm. of them, they can't get away from it. It's everywhere. It's all around them. Mm-hmm. Have we equipped, having been on both sides of that fence, mm-hmm. do you think we've equipped young people to deal with that?
So I think that social media, this is an area that is really important, and I think the kids are so plugged in on social media, and that's really one area where they are getting their news, which is a problem. I think we're actually seeing, podcasts and people who may listen to Charlotte Talks, that accessibility of news is different. I mean, our parents' generation sat down at 6:30 every single night and got the news in 30 minutes, but, you know, that news is changing by the hour, and so that kind of pressure and, it is that people respond to the news cycle in pretty profound ways.
And some kids hear things and don't necessarily ask about them, and they stress mm-hmm. out because they've heard things that they don't completely understand, and particularly with regard to school shootings, which we'll come back mm-hmm. and talk about in a minute or two. In an academic environment, Tom, whether it's a public school or it's a private school, what do you see as the major stressors in your students' life? And are they really that much worse than they were in the Pleistocene age when I went to school?
Well, that's a great question. I think the greatest stressors really are external factors, external pressure. And I think we put a lot of burden on parents and blame on parents for that external pressure. But when you're in a culture that has achievement orientation in all kinds of ways, you mentioned a competitive environment earlier. I think part of it is that we've just kind of instilled in kids, and they're swimming in this water, which is everything's competitive. Success is only based on about three things that are important in the world and in life. And I don't think it's just parents. I think it's a big bucket of culture that has created that, and it is way worse than when I was a kid and kind of going through this. And, you know, my parents were happy to have me doing something constructive, but there was not pressure to have a resume.
But could students of our generation, and I'm older than you, so our two generations, could they have had some of these same pressures and just not talked about it? People not aware of it. We weren't aware of a lot of stuff and didn't used to talk about a lot of things that we explore now openly.
Yeah, I agree. I did grow up in a pressure cooker place. I grew up in a very affluent part of Chicago, on literally the other side of the tracks. But the pressure for kids there was extraordinary. And I had, three people who I knew well who committed suicide while they were there. And that was because of the pressure that they were under as these high-achieving families. And I think that's just broadened.
We talk a lot on this program and others about a group of young people that we should talk about and should help, at-risk youth who are at risk because of economic factors and because of the neighborhoods in which they live and their family situation. But evidently, well-to-do children are also, in some cases, at risk. A study out of Arizona State indicates that rich kids, their words, not mine, in middle and high school have higher rates of alcohol and drug abuse on average than poor kids and much higher rates than the national norm. And that report clinically significant depression or anxiety at a rate of 2 to 3 times the national average. And the major factor of all of this is pressure, which, quote, leaves them tired, feeling inadequate, and very alone. How many instances of that do you see here and in your practice, doctor?
I would say that's very common. And it seems to me in the 20 years I've been practicing here in Charlotte that it is increasing. The kids are getting less sleep. They're staying up later to do homework because they feel they have to make that grade. They can't skip a practice or fail.
Where does that come from? Themselves, their teachers, their coaches, their parents? Where does that come from?
I think it comes from all of the above. And then, unfortunately, that does become internalized. So these external rewards or this conditional acceptance or love or your merit and your worth are on all of these external factors, which is very dangerous because then when you lose one of those, then you have the repercussion of disappointing your parent or in their minds maybe rejecting that.
So how did we get here? What has happened? What has changed in the culture that we have to make these kids super successful by the time they're 12? What has happened?
I think,
it's okay.
Mr. Tom Franz.
All of you can answer. Go ahead and answer the question.
I think you nailed it. You said that it's just this very narrow view of success, and it hinges on these just handful of things rather than what we know to be important to human happiness and success, which is feeling competent and feeling connected to others, having a higher purpose, and that autonomy, your ability to just make your own decisions and be who you are.
I think the message I got when I was graduating from school is that, my parents' generation, they all had pensions, and a lot of them worked at the same company for 30 years. And I think there was a message that I certainly received as someone who was not from my parents necessarily, but just from sort of the broader community, that we were trying so hard to be able to be as successful as possible because the job market was unknown. And especially when you're entering the job market at a time the economy is not great, you really want your kid to be able to be financially sound and be able to have the life that they want. And so I think there is a pressure that the job market's changed. Millennials change jobs more than any other generation, and so there is that piece that I think that success is put on. And as the doc over here told us, it's sometimes external. And I think especially with parents, there was a great study that The Atlantic highlighted in a recent article that we'll be talking about during the talk at Trinity tomorrow, that said that 80% of kids say that their parents value achievement over their own happiness and care. And even if the parents aren't aware of that, that's a problem, right?
And are these just everyday run-of-the-mill kids, or are these particularly
younger,
well-to-do kids?
These are overall younger kids.
Okay.
So the sort of Trinity.
So how much of this, the desire for your kids to succeed, the desire to get them into a great college, which sets them up for a great career and family life success going forward, how much of that is real? Absolutely necessary to do that. And how much of that is anecdotal and you just think you got to do it, so by gosh, we're going to do it?
Well, I think there was an article probably 10 years ago in the New York Times, I think it was, that talked about how it wasn't that much more difficult to get into college if you actually took away all the grade point weighting that was part of it. So I'm not sure it's actually that much different. I just think the perception, again, is that it's that much more challenging.
Tom Francis, head of Trinity Episcopal School. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Tom Franz, head of Trinity Episcopal School. Dr. Melanie Powell is a pediatric neuropsychologist and the founding and managing partner or managing psychologist at MindSpark. And Luis Serio is a former producer, news producer at CBS News and alumnus of Trinity Episcopal School. Lindsay emails, my seventh grader has already concluded that he will not be able to get into Chapel Hill because of the competitiveness of his high school, which is a public high school. How can we address this very real issue as parents when the reality is it is harder for smart kids to get into college? Who wants to tackle that? You're the educator here. We'll start with you,
well,
Tom.
You know, I would say a couple things. One is there's lots of great schools, and I think part of the stress that we're all feeling is we've all kind of identified the name brand, as I like to call them, colleges and universities that our kids need to go to or the kids want to go to. And I think that's part of the overall competitive challenge that's creating stress for us. I would also say a little tip for those who are out there. Actually, if you can go to the most rural part of North Carolina and be the valedictorian, you can actually get into Carolina easier than being at some really rigorous schools that are maybe public schools or private schools.
Why has it become more difficult for kids to get into public higher institutions like UNC?
Yeah. I'll give
Why?
You a simple answer is U.S. News and World Reports. In their ranking system that they came out with, whatever it was 25 years ago, that I think has totally blown up the perception. And that's why I say name brand schools, because they're rank ordered in this way in which, yes, kids are getting a great education, but it implies that it's the only place you can get a great education and get a great job afterwards.
We have done many shows preparing parents to prepare their kids to get into college with experts in that field. And one of those experts has told me more than once on this program, if you're a parent and you're obsessing over getting your child into school X, whatever it may be, and it doesn't happen, it's not the end of the world. Getting into the right college is not going to necessarily set you up for life, and not getting it is not going to set you up for failure. Do you agree?
I agree 100%, and I would say that about 95% of the time, the college process works as it's intended, which is to find a right fit or good fit college for a particular child and student.
So we've been talking about success, and I was going to ask this question later in the program, but Hugh on Facebook is going to ask it for us. He says, define success, define succeed. What does that mean? I'm sure it's different for everybody. In your mind, when you're dealing with students who are going through these mental health crises based on school, what is in their mind? What is success to them?
I think to the children, they're absorbing whatever the culture says. So it's having the fame, the fortune, the accolades, these external measures. But in the psychological research, it's having, again, that autonomy. And what I'm looking at when I'm doing evaluations is trying to find that right fit for this particular child. What are their unique gifts and talents? And how do we nurture those and direct the child towards those areas of interest so that their passions and their skill sets set them up for success?
What happens when their passions and their skill sets don't match their parents' passions and desires for their children?
I think that's where
that's the problem?
Stress.
Yes, the stress. And I see it all the time. So if I have a child who I'm raving about to a parent and saying, oh my gosh, your child is so wonderful and he's just incredibly nice and the teachers had glowing things to say about him and da-da-da-da-da, and he wants to do, you know, whatever in the outdoors, and they sort of drop their shoulders and are like, but, okay, he's not going to make any money with that. And I know the kids feel that when they get home.
How did you define success, A, as a college student, and B, once you got into the field, your first field of being a news producer? How did you define success?
So I think I thought of it probably in the traditional way that a lot of folks think about it, which was I was trying to be the very best at everything that I did. I became the youngest associate producer in the CBS News Bureau, but that also meant that You know, every single Saturday night for my whole mid-20s, I was going to bed at 8 p.m. so I could be there on the morning show at 5 a.m., right? So, you know, success, a lot of, I think I thought I was successful. I think my friends who were all having a good time on Saturday nights were like, I don't know if that's success, right? And I think my view of success has definitely changed and evolved as I've figured out what's valuable to me. But I think the most important thing to think about, and I think about that, you know, the woman who has a seventh grader in Chapel Hill who wants to go to Chapel Hill is thinking about why does that seventh grader want to go to Chapel Hill, right? What is the parent maybe put on that to sort of stoke in that direction? And really, I think the question we want to ask parents is, you know, when your kid is 28 and sitting across the kitchen table from you, what do you want them to look like? And if it's happiness, that's one thing. If it's, you know, a JD from Chapel Hill, it's another thing.
I don't know if you were pushed by your parents, but to get to become a news producer at any network at 20, most of them are pretty young, but you have to be special to be at that level, at that age. Would you do it again? And if you had a child who aspired to that, how would you guide them and their desires for their own success without putting your stamp on it?
Such a hard question. So, I don't regret it at all. I learned so much and I met the most amazing people. I think that if I had, I would absolutely do it all again. I think that, especially thinking about kids, I would encourage them to do what excites them, right? And for me, that was journalism. I loved telling stories. I loved meeting new people and talking to people who were different from me. And I just kind of aggressively followed that.
Well, that leads us to, you alluded to this, Doctor, the fact that they're not going to make any money at that if they pursue their passion, because there is an old adage, do what you love and the money will come. I'm not sure that's true. I think you do what you love and you're going to be poor the rest of your life.
Well, I would say that do what you love, do what you're good at.
Yeah.
And that can afford you to live, right? I mean, I think the third part, it absolutely has to be part of that.
You went to Vassar.
I did.
And then you became a CBS News producer. Unless you're Nora O'Donnell, you're not making a lot of money.
Right. Exactly.
So is that success?
You know, I think I was happy for a long time, and I was growing. I think that most millennials actually say that what they want at work is growth. The latest Pew research shows that they're not, a lot of millennials aren't getting the growth opportunities they want. I felt like at CBS especially, I had the growth experience anytime I wanted because there was always need, right? You could jump in and I think especially like as we're thinking about what we want to instill in kids today, that's very much being resilient and jumping in and anticipating needs and being able to really, jump in and show your skills. So I think that's a good place for that.
The Guardian, which is a British publication, has done a lot of studies about this in the UK, and they have referred to this generation of students as a generation in crisis. In this country, we hear a lot about snowflakes and people who need trigger warnings and safe spaces to go to. Do you think any of that is an accurate way to describe this generation, Doctor?
I think it minimizes their stress and their strain. And what I see, I'm kind of piggybacking what you were bringing up, Louise, was that because there's all of these external attainment, achievement that kids feel pressured to reach for, they're scared to death to take risks. And I've seen this over and over again with testing for sure. And now I'm seeing it with the 4 and 5 year olds. So it used to be that overwhelmingly those kids at that age, they love school, they love to learn, they're really inquisitive, but they're already getting the feedback that you need to be memorizing your ABCs and you need to know how to write your name and you should be reading by now. And they are scared to try. And I think, how do we teach problem solvers and innovators if they're afraid to take risks?
Well, that leads us to the other thing. They're being pushed by their parents. And parents today, there's this helicopter parenting thing that we hear a lot about. And kids are shepherded right through law school in some cases, where the parents will call the dean and say, my kid got a C and he should have gotten a B, fix this. And they're 23 years old. I mean, back off. Mm-hmm. But that's happening a lot. Is that worse than the pressure that they're putting on their kids to succeed? The fact that they're not letting go and allowing them to fail on their own and pick themselves up, so they're not equipped.
Yes, yes. And definitely, I think the short-term goals, that's what those parents, that's what's jacking up their pressure and their anxiety. They're looking like, well, you've got to make this grade to get this into this class or get into that class next year and da-da-da-da-da up to college. And when you're looking in very short-sighted ways, then they're quicker to jump in and rescue them with homework or run a book back to school. But then over time, then those children, you're right, have not developed the resilience and the figure it out. You know, you have to own your mistakes because the parents are so concerned.
A writer in the Washington Post wrote about his own, and his name was John Nichols, I'm not sure who he is, but he wrote about his own teenager's experience in school. They sat him down. These kids sat him down to explain why their pressures were as real as his pressures at work. And he mentioned something that I imagine most of us have not really thought of in a long time, where adults may have one boss at work. These kids have six, because usually when they get to high school, they've got six different classes at least that they take, and each of those classes is run by a teacher who's the boss with their own expectations, and they don't really take into consideration the other teacher's expectations and the load the other teachers have put on these kids. And these kids have to deal with that, and they're 15, 16, 17 years old. Are teachers aware of that? Does that cross their minds?
Well, I think teachers certainly are, and I think, you know, teachers are probably more sensitive to than anybody, the whole kind of stress. I'm not big on, you know, holding parents only accountable. I do think it's societal, and I do think that if you send your kid to a competitive school where competition is important, the culture of the place creates that environment as well. And so I think parents are responsible, not necessarily for the stress that their kid is feeling, but responsible to make sure that their kid is living in a healthy way. And I do think that we have these, you know, interesting academic schedules, and yet my guess is you went through the same kind of, you know, manufacturing approach to education as kids are going through now. Sadly, yeah. We haven't changed
it
a whole lot.
So why is it harder today then? Why is that even a factor? I mean, I had six or seven classes with six or seven teachers and papers to write and homework to do and extracurricular activities. You just dealt with it. Pick yourself up and deal with it. Are kids not equipped to do with that or to deal with it today? I mean, are there more pressures coming from someplace else?
Yes, I think there are all the competing factors that we've already mentioned, the sports, the schools, the colleges, right. And then you have social media, which you may be getting to, but it's in their face all of the time. And one of the things I believe that children are getting robbed of right now is because everything is publicized and all over the world, if you make a mistake, there's no safe place to make mistakes. Back when I was a kid, we all do dumb things, and teenagers are going to do risky behavior. Their frontal cortex isn't developed yet, so they're impulsive, and they do short-sighted things. But now, for children, if they have those mistakes, mishaps, it is all over Snapchat or Instagram, and everybody knows about it. So they're not even given that freedom to mess up.
And the other thing that's all over social media are their peers' successes. I would think more successes than failure are posted on social media, which makes their world look so much better than my world. How much is that contributing to anxiety and depression and just feelings of inadequacy?
That's huge. Just this morning at the breakfast table, my daughter showed me an Instagram post where someone had written to their 20-something niece and said, oh, it looks like you're having a great time at college because of all of her posts. And she said, yeah, Tina, I didn't post pictures of me crying in the library by myself.
The jokes about parents needing to get their kids into the right daycare started coming out in the 1970s in sitcoms and plays. And maybe that's led to this. Maybe because there's truth in comedy, that the source of comedy is truth. Mm-hmm. Some of that is true. But you think it's built on itself, the need to get my kid into the right daycare so they can get into the right kindergarten, so they get into the right private elementary school, which gets into the right high school, college, etc. It begins at four.
Yeah, I think the parents are incredibly anxious today, for sure, and that they have seen kind of this is the path, whether it's connected to daycare, preschool, school, wherever that is. I think parents are anxious, and they really have swooped in. You know, the whole what does it look like for parents to swoop in? And I would say that, you know, Michael Thompson, who's an educational psychologist 30 years ago, would say that, listen, 95% of parents are all well-intended advocates. And if you can work with them and help them understand what's good for their child, you can make some real progress. And 5% are crazy. And I would just suggest, I would just suggest that the crazy has shifted, right? So crazy didn't used to mean showing up at a job interview with your child, right? Nobody would have ever done that. So the whole stress has shifted for parents, and parents are very much interested in their child's success. And I would say parents disproportionately now are interested in their child's success so that they can, it reflects well on them as parents, right, in a different way than probably, I don't think my parents really cared.
This is a little off topic, but I'm just curious. Have you ever worked with somebody whose parents went to their job interview with them? And if, whether you have or not, what kind of pressure does that put on somebody? Your mom or your dad is sitting next to you in the waiting room for this job interview. Is that, to me, that would drive me out the door.
No, I haven't seen that yet, but I have seen parents who are in their children's emails and are managing their email accounts and emailing teachers for them, and, you know, at their, you know, sporting events and coaching them from the side.
So that's all good intentions. They're doing that because they want the best for their kids. So how do you, and I know you work principally with children, who works with the parents? Who weans the parents away from these habits?
That's great. Hopefully, psychologists and other parents. And the anxiety really feeds off of itself. There's this park bench culture. So one parent might say to the other one, oh, well, I've done, you know, I've started up Johnny and these lessons. And then the parent's like, oh, they are? Well, oh my gosh, do I need to be doing that? And it just starts younger and younger.
You run a private school, Time Franz, and I'm wondering, there must be entrance requirements to get into your school, are there?
Yes.
And once a child is in that school and the parents have decided that's the direction they want their child to go in, do you think there are more pressures put on those children to succeed? And do you think that children in your classrooms feel that pressure?
I think, again, I go back to, I think there are some kids who are feeling tons of pressure. There's a few middle school boys who I wish felt a little more pressure, right? And I think that's developmentally appropriate to be a little scattered. And so I think it's just a societal thing more than just the parents putting their kids there. I think parents are trying to find the best educational opportunity for their kids. But I do agree with Melanie that lots of this stuff has gotten pushed down in a way that's really unhealthy for kids. The whole idea of being able to play and create your own games instead of being put in an organized sport, that really isn't going to amount to much. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is now out and about talking about the whole idea of competitive sports leading to college scholarships, and it's actually probably not worth it to get a college scholarship unless you're going to go professional in that sport.
We're talking about stress and young people, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the stresses that young people feel in their lives, in their classrooms, in their extracurricular activities, from their parents, from their teachers, from their coaches. It's a terrible world. We're here with Tom Franz, who is the head of Trinity Episcopal School. Dr. Melanie Powell is a pediatric neuropsychologist and founder and managing partner, managing psychologist at Mind Spark. And Louise Serio is a former producer at CBS News who has now moved on to other things. And we're going to talk about how life has changed for you in the absence of that pressure. But Tom, you brought up something just before the break about having to do certain things because it looks good on your college resume. You didn't phrase it that way, but a lot of kids play multiple sports as opposed to concentrating on one, or they concentrate on one sport so that they can become a professional football player. Mm-hmm. They start at 5, and by the time they're 18, they're ready to go to college for a year and then go to the NFL or the NBA if basketball is their thing. How important is that? How important is having participated in lots of sports or one sport to extreme skill set or being involved in lots of different extracurricular things and civic projects, how important is that?
I think some of it is really important, and it should be driven by the child's interest, not the parent's expectation. I think that's where the disconnect and the stress really comes from, is the parents want their kids to do A, B, or C, and the child wants to do X, Y, and Z, and so they end up having the kids do A, B, and C, and the kid gets to do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, that was my experience. I have two kids that were college athletes, one of whom, played Division I sports. And I always said, listen, we're going to invest in this. We're going to invest in this both time and money, and you can never complain about it. Because if you love doing this, I want to support you in that. And if they didn't love it, then we ought to go find something else to do. And I think that's true for any activity. If kids love it and it's something beneficial for them, we ought to support our kids 100%. And if they don't love it, we need to just reassess kind of what we should be doing with them.
Years ago, Ed Bradley on 60 Minutes did a story about underprivileged young people who had been written off, and somehow they found their way to this school in Manhattan that did not let them off the hook. Mm-hmm. They pushed them, and they rose, they rose to the level of those expectations. That's a kind of pressure that is beneficial because these kids were going to fail, and now they are successful. Is there a danger in lessening the pressure on high and overachievers? Because if you take that pressure away, are they likely to slack off and not achieve what they might have achieved had the pressure remained? It's a delicate balance.
Louise can answer this, but I think Louise and lots of other kids are self-motivated. They're intrinsically motivated, they love, they're driven, and we don't need to put external pressure on them. There's other kids who need pressure, and I think that's the real goal as parents and educators is trying to figure out what are those motivators for individual kids and not just uniformly say, here's the expectation, live up to it, or you're not good enough.
Do you want to take a shot at that, Louise?
Yes. Sorry. No, that's fine. I think there was a research study, I don't have it at my fingertips, that talked about for high achievers, high performing kids, that those external rewards and incentives kind of backfire and undermine their motivation. For low achievers, like the struggling readers, the struggling kids, they really need the narrative, the commentary of you can do this. It's building their confidence. And I think that there's a difference between being an involved parent or teacher that says, I care about you, where you have this emotional connection with the child, I'm confident you can do this, versus the intrusive one who's setting unrealistic expectations and things they're not developmentally ready for.
They say that if you want to be an actor, you shouldn't be an actor unless you have to be an actor. That's the thing that drives you and fulfills you. And the same, I think, is true to a great extent to people who go into broadcasting. I mean, mm-hmm. because there are no holidays and there are no weekends and there are odd hours and you have to do it. It's not a question of, well, I think I'll turn down that 5 a.m. shift. I'll do the 10 a.m. No. So what drove you? Where did that come from in you? And why wasn't that a stressor on your life, Louise?
So I feel like for me, it was a spark that got really started when I started reading the news. I loved reading the news, and it was sort of a research piece almost that I loved, gathering as much information as possible. I idolized people, especially at CBS, and I wanted to be like them, and I drove myself for that. And I think it's different, to Tom's point of being really resilient versus like just having so much pressure around you. I didn't feel a lot of external pressure as much until really I left, actually. Was a couple people told me who had left CBS, like, it's going to be really hard to tell your parents because they're going to be disappointed in you, right? Like, you've got a big, cool job, and they're going to be sad. And, and they weren't really. But I think the way that the pressure is more about, a reflection on the parents, I think, was what Tom said, when I think that's true.
The reality is, aside from UNC Chapel Hill, which is evidently difficult to get into now, the reality is that elite universities are really difficult to get into. They're accepting a smaller and smaller number of young people to come in. In 2019, Harvard admitted just 4.5% of the 43,330 applicants that wanted to get in. Doesn't that make parents and teachers and guidance counselors push students even harder? Because if you have to be supremely good to be among that 4.3%.
Yes, I think when you're talking about the most elite colleges and universities, they are actually picking students to create a class, right? And we used to have well-rounded people that were trying to get into these schools, and now you have to be well lopsided and you have to have some spike talent or have, you know, produced a play on Broadway or something in order to get in. And the numbers are hugely inflated. The numbers are hugely inflated by U.S. News and World Reports, and as a ranking. The numbers are hugely inflated by the college app process, the Common App,
right,
because now it's easy to push click and send way differently than it once was to get it in the mail and go through that process. So I think, and unfortunately, you know, the elite colleges and universities have tried to push that number to smaller and smaller and smaller because it seems to mean something. But this article, I wish I could remember the title and when it was published about a decade ago, would essentially have said that for the most part, with the exception of maybe some of the most elite colleges, lots of schools have kids who are very similar getting into their schools as they were 30 years ago with similar kinds of grades. But because we've, you know, given two grade point bumps for an AP class and one for an honors class, we've convoluted this whole process to have this escalation of GPAs, which is kind of ridiculous. And, you know, smaller schools can actually just pull out all of the grades and they don't care what the GPA bumps are. They just look at, you know, the letter grades or the scores, and they are able to randomize those. It gets more complicated with large public universities where there's kind of a first cutoff threshold after which, you know, then they'll start reading the applications more substantively.
The Journal of Psychoeducational Assessment, I hope you're familiar with that, I was not, reports that students tend to try harder and enjoy school more when they work toward their own ideals of perfectionism. That may be true, and I think that probably is true, but how do you find your own ideal of perfectionism when you're being pushed from the grade, from 5 years old up to conform to these standards?
I think that's the danger of forcing kids to specialize too early, to do things that they're not developmentally ready for, because all that does is just narrow their scope. They're not exposed to new things. They're not taking risks. And we used to let kids try and fail in low-risk activities so that they can figure out what their strength is or what their calling is. And because we're narrowing that definition and access, kids are already boxed in at a really young age.
This Journal of Psychoeducational Assessment says that they're happier when they're directing their own destiny, which tells me you're happier when you're in control of yourself and where you want to go. And these kids are more motivated. To make that happen, is it simply telling kids to take that approach, or do we have to do something systemically with parents and teachers and schools and other things?
Yes, if you want to create more autonomy, you've got to back off and give kids the space to do that. That it's the pressure that limits them and shuts them down. Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I there is a lot of pressure, and I think some kids feel it, and culture has created it. And you know, I'll just go back to the social media thing. I do think that it's really difficult to have yourself getting feedback about yourself and your life,
right,
on a regular basis when your brain is young and malleable. And I just think it makes it more difficult for kids to grow in healthy ways.
So we've been talking a lot about stresses that come from academic achievement and the drive to achieve academically and get into the right school and the pressures that parents put on their kids to do all that. But the stresses that some of these young people are feeling come from all different places, which we started our conversation about with regard to social media, to the news that's coming into them, even if it's just peripheral in the background, and fear, school shootings. Let's talk about that for a second. They've certainly raised fears and anxiety levels among young people. You covered the Parkland shootings, Louise, and met these young people struggling to come to terms with what had just happened around them. You were there on the ground the very next day. And I think you, after being there and talking to these kids and covering this story, also sought, and I hope I'm not breaking confidence here, sought professional help of your own to deal with this. Are there coping skills that you learned in that process that young people can adopt, even if they haven't witnessed this themselves. It's just in the undercurrent in the back of their heads.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of that comes actually to the college process, right? So I remember I did get to Parkland the night of the shooting. It was like 3 a.m., so I guess the next day. And I remember that morning sitting down with David Hogg, who's obviously, you know, everyone's household name now. And he was dealing with the stinging grief of a college rejection letter that he'd gotten that week. And it's sort of like you're looking at this whole big scope of this awful event, and there's also all the awful other stuff that's happening to you in high school at the same time. So I think part of that, for me, covering that shooting and, afterwards, I did have PTSD and still have problems in crowds sometimes. I think that thinking very much about what I wanted my life to be, and it sort of, some people respond to moments of crisis as kind of clarifying what you want out of your life. And I think certainly for me, that was the case. I wanted to step back a little bit. And I think that for kids, any opportunity you can take to really think very hard about what you want for your future. And remember that future isn't just college. That's 4 years. But in the working world, we were just talking about this on the way over, no one's asking where you went to college, right? They want to know who you are and what kind of person you are. So I think for me, covering that shooting especially, I was thinking very much about, who I was and what I wanted out of my future. And I think the more that we can prompt kids to really self-reflect rather than just kind of check all the boxes that you want to check on your way through a college admissions process is important.
The fact that school shootings seemed to be coming at a relatively quick rate for a while, and the fact that that was all over the news and it affected kids in elementary school and high school and in colleges and universities, and it was always that undercurrent going on. The fact that that was happening, when I went to school, we had fire drills. We had nuclear drills. We had to get under our desks or cover our heads in the hallway, which even as a child, I thought, well, this is silly. But now they have security systems in schools, and they have active shooter drills. And there's some question about whether or not they should have those drills. What's your take on that? And what kind of anxiety is that adding to a student's life?
Yes, I think that's adding a ton of anxiety to students, and there's been research that's coming out recently that's traumatizing for children. And speaking as a parent, I had a child at a big public high school here, and one of the school shooting drills, they don't always tell the kids that it's a drill, and she was racing to class. It when another young gentleman just shouted across the squad, "We're all going to die." Mm. And I'm sure he was reprimanded for that, but it just adds to the angst. And unnecessarily, then when they had the tornado the other week, they weren't prepared for the tornado. She said, "Well, I haven't done a tornado since I was in middle school."
What about the future? How worried, how concerned, how much anxiety does the worry about the future? These kids hear things. They know that robots are coming and artificial intelligence is coming and that jobs are going to be affected by that. And as much as they may study, those jobs may not exist. We know that climate change is a factor in a lot of young people's lives. What role is that playing? And how do you deal with that? It's coming. The future's coming. It's on the way. It's here now. Well, it'll be here in a second.
I guess it's just that they haven't had the life experiences yet. It's hard for them to weigh the options. And I think, I alluded to this earlier, but it's those short-term goals and the short-term rewards or outcomes that heighten the anxiety or pressure. And when you can take that long view of, in 10 years from now, this isn't going to matter, or in the broad scheme of things, this is okay.
Are there coping mechanisms that young people who are to recognize what's causing their anxiety and then to help them tamp it down? Are there coping mechanisms that they can use?
Meditation is a great one. Just self-reflection and insight and taking that time, that pause that I think Tom was saying, that or you were saying it too, Louise, that 5 minutes to just breathe and just play that unstructured white space, as I refer to it sometimes. I feel like over and over again, I'm telling parents, slow it down, pull back on the activities. Like, this is too much. They just need some time to self-reflect, and I don't think they have any time to do that.
Hmm. Dr. Melanie Powell is a pediatric neuropsychologist and the managing psychologist and founder of Mind Spark. Luis Serio, an alumnus of Trinity Episcopal School and of Vassar, and CBS News, and Tom Franz, who's the head of Trinity Episcopal School. I was going to ask you about when kids should actually start preparing for the SAT. You got a 5-second answer? What age?
I don't think they need to until they get ready to take the SAT.
All right. Okay. We'll leave it at that. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.